Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Courtney Smith will be on to talk about the joys and obstacles facing the female music nerd. The mainstream media finally admits that the war on contraception is a war on contraception, and Michelle Bachmann gets even nastier in her attacks on the HPV vaccine. Unfortunately, a personhood amendment is going forward in Mississippi.
Our founding fathers guaranteed all persons life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But who is a person?
I am a person.
I am a person.
I am a person.
I am a person.
Regardless of age, race, gender, and no matter how small, every human life has infinite value and deserves protection under our laws. Think about it.
As a reminder, the hope of anti-choicers is that by defining a fertilized egg as a person, they can not only outlaw abortion, but they can also see every woman, even those who aren't pregnant, as potentially having a person inside her, which could mean outlawing some forms of birth control, certain kinds of employment, and could give the police an excuse to criminalize women for having menstrual periods or miscarriages the government decides somehow look fishy. I probably don't have to tell you, podcast listeners, how frustrating it is to talk about the problem that is the mainstream media ignoring the right-wing war on contraception. Oh, it gets covered here and there, but there's this strange unwillingness on the part of the mainstream media to call it for what it is. Instead, you see reporters bend themselves into pretzels trying to figure out how anti-choicers who oppose contraception access are really all about abortion. And that's because accepting that they oppose STD treatment and contraception right along abortion means accepting that the entire mainstream media frame for abortion rights, aka women versus fetuses, is totally wrong. They would have to instead revisit the issue and admit that it's all about sex and how much anti-choicers fear and loathe female sexuality. And if they did that, they'd get angry letters. I know, because I get angry letters from anti-choicers who somehow have it in their head that others are obligated to lie on their behalf and present them as fetus lovers when their behavior actually suggests sex phobes. Anyway, the situation lately is this. The tacit agreement between the mainstream media and anti-choicers, where the mainstream media pretends antis are all about fetuses and the antis agree to keep their hatred of contraception a little bit quiet, it's all falling apart. This is because anti-choicers got cocky and started thinking they could openly attack contraception without being called on it. And for months, they did get away with this, because the mainstream media doesn't want to give up their pre-existing narratives, no matter how false. And then this happened on NPR.
Until recently, opposition to publicly funded birth control was usually linked to abortion, either because the birth control in question allegedly caused abortion or because the organization providing the birth control also performed abortions. This is changing, though. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, there's a growing chorus of voices who simply don't think the government should be funding contraception.
When the Obama administration last month added contraceptives to the list of services insurance plans must offer without deductibles or copayments, the reaction from the right was swift. Here's Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King on the House floor.
They called it preventative medicine. Preventative medicine. Well, if you apply that preventative medicine universally, what you end up with is you've prevented a generation.
It is true that it was linked to abortion before, but that's not because of any specific objection to abortion per se. The reason anti-choicers link their objections to contraception to abortion is that it was part of the game. They pretend that this is about fetuses and the media agrees to take them at their word. What we're seeing now isn't a new sentiment, really. The right has always been hostile to contraception, which is why they supported abstinence-only education, which would be better described as anti-contraception propaganda. They just knew that their objections to contraception were easier to sell if they were attached to something else, like education or abortion. Now they're trying to tie their hatred of contraception to healthcare reform and federal spending. But the constant here has always been an objection to contraception. And NPR is finally beginning to admit that all this hostility to contraception might actually be rooted in a hostility to contraception. I do suppose it helps to have Representative King imply that babies won't be born without force, and Sandy Rios compare preventing pregnancy to getting your nails done. Right-wingers are getting bolder in their attacks, but these sentiments have always been there. NPR even responsibly explained why there's still a high abortion rate, even though contraception is legal.
Abortion opponents are correct that widespread access to birth control hasn't eliminated abortions in this country, although the number has declined considerably over the past two decades. But supporters of birth control like Stewart say the reason is that there hasn't been enough access to contraception. Funding for the federal government's main family planning program has largely remained flat over the years, mostly due to abortion-related fights, so it hasn't kept up with inflation or population growth. As a result, Stewart says,
millions and millions of Americans who are in need of publicly funded family planning services today are not getting access to family planning services.
In fact, as I covered with Lawrence Finer in last week's interview, the unintended pregnancy rate for women who can afford contraception has gone down dramatically, taking the abortion rate for that group with it. But the unintended pregnancy rate and the abortion rate for women living in poverty has gone up dramatically. And I imagine that the reasons NPR gives are right. The price of birth control has been climbing for years as income inequalities continue to grow. Poor women have simply been priced out of contraception. But hey, there's still some right-wing nuts on hand to explain that it's all about the evils of sex.
But Helen Alvarez, a law professor at George Mason University, says she thinks there may be yet another reason why widespread use of birth control hasn't brought down the rate of unintended pregnancy more dramatically.
If you lower the cost of things, people will buy more of it. And you lower the cost of uncommitted sexual encounters. You completely dissociate sex from pregnancy and birth and a lifetime of childcare. People will engage in more uncommitted sexual encounters.
This argument only makes sense if you assume that people having sex is a de facto bad thing, and the government should consider it a scourge to stomp out. And even then, it doesn't make sense. She has no evidence whatsoever that punishing people with STDs and unintended pregnancy has stomped out this scourge of sex that she hates so much. But even if you assume that it lowers the number of overall sexual encounters, so what? Is sex so evil that it's worth inducing a public health crisis to raise the price of it? I would argue that if you think sex is evil, argue for it on those grounds. Convince people to avoid sex of their own free will. But using government policy to impose punishments for sex because your religion teaches that sex is evil? I would argue that it's a violation of the First Amendment because it's an attempt to impose your specific religious teachings through government force. If my religion forbade enjoying food, it wouldn't be right for me to try and get rid of food safety regulations. If I said, if you eat, you should run the risk of dying of botulism because the fear of it will make you eat less, people would think I was mad. And that's how we should approach people who want to invoke a public health crisis in order to satisfy their esoteric religious teachings. I'd like to welcome Courtney Smith to the program. Courtney has parlayed her experience as a music blogger and an MTV music programmer into a new memoir slash book on music called Record Collecting for Girls, Unleashing Your Inner Music Nerd One Album at a Time. She's here to talk about being a woman in the wild, woolly world of music snobbery. Welcome to RealityCast, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me.
So music collecting and snobbery is really considered like a male-dominated thing, more so than a lot of other hobbies. Why do you think this is?
Well, a lot of it is dictated by men, the way that records are marketed, the way that the music industry is staffed, who gets the money. And the whole world of being in record stores is not really something that's aimed at women. It's not really designed in a way that's, you know, welcoming to what we like. And the way that it's talked about is so often really statistical, and in terms of who the artist is and who put out their record and just knowing a lot of facts as opposed to, I don't know, talking about your feelings. So I decided to write something that was about my feelings and my experience. And it was a big deal to me to make it for women, talking to women, because most music books also have been marketed to men in the history. And women are really just seen as the gravy. It's like a nice thing if we buy it, but we're not the primary audience. And I wanted to turn that entire idea on its head.
So what specifically about record stores do you find is not good for women or somehow discouraging to women?
I feel like I've had some really not awesome experiences in record stores personally. There's the one that really comes to mind is a record store in Dallas that I used to go to all the time. And it was, oh my gosh, they don't put prices on anything in the store. It's that kind of place. You just take up what you want to the register, and then the guy that owns the store works at the register, and he assesses you, your coolness and who you are, if he knows you, and decides what he's going to charge you. And a lot of my guy friends worked at that record store, and they were always like, Courtney, he's overcharging you by a lot. Just let us buy these for you. And I never would, because it's a point of pride. I'm just like, no, I'm not going to do it because, you know, he thinks you're cooler than me or whatever. It was horrible and awful, and I hated it. And I found that, like, some of the snobby record stores, the only people that would even talk to me at some of them would be the girls that worked there. And the guys would, you know, there was no acknowledgement, no discussion. And I don't like it.
Do you think the movie High Fidelity kind of captured that dynamic well?
Yeah, it was perfectly written. The book and the movie, that scene, it was incredibly accurate.
The scene where he yells at the guy who's trying to buy I forget what record it was, but...
It's a Stevie Wonder record. Yeah, that's in both of them. But just in the movie was another scene of a guy that wants to buy some rare album who comes in and looks at it every week, and they refuse to sell it to him because he's a nerd, and their friend who they think is cool is like, well, I don't have that, I'll buy it off of you. And he's like, all right, here you go. And that's pretty accurate.
So how did you personally get into music collecting?
Well, it started when I was really young, playing in my parents' record collection. They actually had a pretty extensive and pretty good one, pretty all over the place. And using it to make mixtapes, their vinyl to make mixtapes, was the way that I really connected with my stepdad when my mom got remarried. You know, it happens when you're young, and it can be hard to form that connection with the new male figure in your life. And that was the one thing we had in common. We both liked music. So that was sort of our bonding.
So, I mean, obviously there are female music nerds out there. How do you think they kind of behave differently than male music nerds, considering the way that things can be, the high-pressure environment?
You know, I don't really think female music nerds act that differently than male music nerds. I think that they're a little less likely to do stuff like make top five lists or, you know, categorize everything at the way that male music nerds do. But I think a lot of it, when you become a music nerd, you just kind of talk in the same language.
So why top five lists instead of like top 10 lists, do you think?
Well, it's a play on the Nick Hornby, on the High Fidelity, really. It's a play on all the top five lists that those guys make. And I remember whenever I first read that book, I was just like, do people actually sit around and talk like this? And then I met a bunch of guys in college who really sat around and talked like that. And I was fascinated. I would listen to them for years making their top five lists, and especially was interested in the top five bands because it seemed like there was an algorithm to it, you know, that I could kind of crack. Like there are certain things everybody did, certain amount of, you know, historical, critically lauded artists that you put in there, and then you throw in that one new person to show how versatile you are. So I started to really think about it and drill down into what the rules could possibly be to make it easier, have kind of a cheat sheet to make a top five if you're not a person who just talks and thinks that way. And so it was kind of fun to break that down. And that's been my favorite part of talking to people about this book. When they read that chapter and start making their own top five list and want to tell me what it is. And then I always make sure to find one band to make fun of just to make sure that they're really dedicated to music taste.
So force them to defend it.
Exactly.
So Now that I think a lot of the music industry has kind of been pushed out of record stores and online, you know, everyone's lamenting that, but do you think it makes a difference for how women consume music?
I think it makes a difference for how everyone consumes music, and I think it makes a difference in what a record collector is. I personally am all about embracing the future. Like, I think I own a book, I own a record, if I own it digitally or if I own a hard copy of it. A lot of people don't and want to stay in the old way of buying things, and that's fine. But I think within 10 years, this idea that a record collector is someone who buys vinyl records has to change. It has to become more inclusive. And there is a sense of exclusivity to MP3s and FLAC files. There are things that you can only find for a limited time online, be it by buying it or because it's only on certain blogs. People just didn't pick it up. It becomes a rarity eventually. It goes out of circulation. Or it's illegal, yeah. But things do go out of circulation digitally as well as physically. I think it's time to really start broadening what a record collector is.
So I read an interview that you did with the Hairpin, and you and the interviewer spoke a lot about mixtapes and mixed CDs, and I guess nowadays we just do playlists that you download, and how they kind of function in the sort of dating world. What would your kind of rules be for a mixtape for somebody you're trying to, like, get with?
Oh my gosh, the first rule is you have to listen to the lyrics closely. You do not want to, like, put some scary song on there that will freak someone out. It happens a lot. People can be a little, like, too blunt and too tactless with their, especially in the world of playlists, now that we all talk to each other online all the time and use our blogs to just out our inner selves constantly, there's this sense that you can just say anything. You really shouldn't. You have to woo people. You have to do it gently, especially in romance. And I would say don't be too overt, and you want to use the mixtape not just to express your own feelings, but to kind of express what you like and maybe give them a glimpse into what you have to offer and the things that are interesting to you via music.
So one last question. So say you're a woman who wants to invest more, become more of a big giant music nerd for whatever reason, but you don't really know where to begin. What advice would you give a woman kind of starting off? Or obviously it's probably going to be a girl.
Yeah, okay. So I would say the best thing to do is get yourself an account for an RDO, Spotify, Grooveshark, any of these services that are basically, it's like getting a library card. So you have everything in the world, really, with a few limitations at your fingertips, just to listen to, just to sort of get into it. Find a few things that you like and then investigate the related artists, investigate the sort of music movement that they were part of. And that's an easy way to find more stuff and new stuff, and you don't have to commit to buying it if you're not that person. You can just check it out like you would check a book out of the library and see what suits you. I do say once you go down that road and you find the stuff you like, do buy copies of it, because artists make a lot more money when you actually buy the album as opposed to just streaming it. And that's important to building a collection of music of your own. But it's just important to get out there and try it out and listen to things.
And what role would you say, like, going to see live music plays in all of this?
I think it's important, and it gives you a different sort of connection with the artist. Sometimes it'll break your heart. Sometimes a band that you really love, you'll go see them live, and it just isn't good. And sometimes it'll change your mind. That it puts a whole new perspective on songs and albums that you've fallen in love with. So I think it's great. I think it's a good thing to do.
My guest today has been Courtney Smith. You can pick up her book, Record Collecting for Girls, Unleashing Your Inner Music Nerd, One Album at a Time, online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me. I got love for you if you were born in the
80s. Few things are as successful at provoking irrational anxieties as the thought that prepubescent girls are going to grow up, go through puberty and become sexually active. That the only alternative to this trajectory is too horrible to speak of somehow doesn't quell the predictable freakout that occurs at the idea that a girl of 11 standing before you today will one day be a woman of 21 and will likely be having sex and otherwise acting like a grown-up. And that grown-up woman of tomorrow deserves her full human rights, including the right to avoid an easily avoidable death from cervical cancer by being fully vaccinated. But such is the panic that female sexuality causes that many people look at that cute 11-year-old girl and want to punish her grown-up self for being a grown-up by withholding vital medical care. Because of this problem, I wasn't really surprised that the HPV vaccine has become a major issue in the Republican primary. For social conservatives, the vaccine has grown in its hated reputation to the point where they speak of it as if the vaccine itself turns cute little girls into adult women with sexual appetites. Michelle Bachmann certainly sounds like that's what she thinks.
And to have innocent little 12-year-old girls be forced to have a government injection through an executive order is just flat out wrong.
It's depressing because I saw even some liberals defending Bachmann's attacks. I realize anxieties about young girls growing into women affect people of all political stripes, but man, that bothers me. The way that she carries on about innocence is a very deliberate provocation of people who simply cannot accept that little girls turn into women. But in fact, there's a good reason that we want to vaccinate so-called innocent little girls and not already sexually active women. It's a vaccine. The point is prevention. You get it before you get exposed, so when you're exposed, you don't get it. Duh. I hate the word innocent to describe virginity, but the hope is that you get the kids while they are in fact virgins, so when they do grow up and start having sex, which they will do, they are protected. Rick Perry's defense of himself makes sense, but as far as that goes, the conservative base isn't hearing it.
At the end of the day, this was about trying to stop a cancer. You may criticize me about the way that I went about it, but at the end of the day, I am always going to err on the side of life.
One thing I've learned in all my years doing this is that people who are all up in a sex panic don't listen to reason. Perry is himself a sex panicker, so he should get this. The only reason he was able to listen to reason on this is Merck gave him money, which made him more open to reason. But no one else has a financial incentive to be reasonable here, so they're all going to freak out and assume that vaccinating girls to prevent STDs will turn them all into sluts. But even I was surprised to hear Bachmann go even further than this slut panic when she came on the Today Show to defend her comments during the debate.
Well, I will tell you that I had a mother last night come up to me here in Tampa, Florida, after the debate. She told me that her little daughter took that vaccine, that injection, and she suffered from mental retardation thereafter.
So now the line is not just that the vaccine turns little girls into sluts, but that it makes them retarded. Awesome. It does no such thing. I don't know where Bachmann got that story, but even on the very slim chance that a woman did say that, I'm guessing the vaccine had nothing to do with it. I had a cup of coffee this morning and then later stubbed my toe, but I don't blame the coffee for it. The only reason every health complaint under the sun gets blamed on this vaccine is that people think of it as the sex vaccine, and sex makes them anxious, and they can't help but think that some deity is punishing them for even thinking about sexual protection instead of simply lashing themselves in shame. Bachmann should be ashamed of herself for scaring parents into not getting their daughters vaccinations, especially since at least some of the parents who opt out will be facing the very real pain and trauma of having a daughter who either has cancer or is rendered infertile from treatments to prevent bad cells from going that direction. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, when your myth-making is beyond even what Sean Hannity can handle edition. Hannity has never met an outrageous claim about the evils of female sexuality that he didn't like, but the whole Gardasil will make you retarded thing caused him to ask questions.
That, so that woman said that to you, is that the
yeah.
Is that one of the side effects of this? Because I've not heard that.
No, I have no idea. All I know is that after the debate, I went down to where to shake people's hands, and a woman came up to me there. She shook my hand. She was crying. She said, "I am so glad that you brought this up." She said the drug's name is Gardasil, and she said that our daughter had one of these injections of Gardasil. She's never been the same. She's suffering with impacts of mental retardation. And she said that this is a very dangerous drug, and I'm glad that you brought this up.
Of course, he didn't grill her hard enough. She even admits that she's not a doctor and doesn't really know anything about this. And that's because it's not true. But because it has to do with girls and sex, she's completely willing to run around the country claiming that Gardasil will turn your little girl retarded. I just can't fathom how irresponsible you have to be to say something like that.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.